session. The Honorable Chief Judge Craig H. Nakamura and Associate Judges Catherine G. Leonard and Lawrence M. Reifert presiding. Please be seated. Calling case number 30156, Harry Winkler and Bishop Insurance Agency, Inc. versus Stephen and Pamela Regan. James Hershey for appellants, Kevin Herring for appellees. Argument on the merits.
Good morning, counsel.
Good morning.
Please proceed.
As you can easily discern from the briefs, we've raised a number of points here. Some of them this court has addressed before, such as the punitive damages and where they should go, for instance, the UNAP case. Others are possibly of a first impression. And one of those would be the issue of whether, if a plaintiff is suing an insurance agent claiming that he failed to procure a policy, doesn't the plaintiff have to come forward and prove that a policy existed, which would cover that particular risk at a premium they could afford and pay? In fact, we noticed that our briefs at this point are a little dated, so I have done a little more research and I have updated, and we did find a couple of new cases. I would like to offer them to the court. I can either just read the cites in my argument, but I have also typed them up.
So you're talking about cases that are not cited in your brief?
They were not, because they didn't happen. One was in 2010, one was in 2012.
Well, the proper way to handle that is to file with the court a 28J letter. I think that's the procedure should be followed. So I don't think it's appropriate for you to refer to cases that are not in your brief that you also have not advised the court of.
Very well, Your Honor. Even without referring to those, basically what we have here is a question that we don't have any case law on anymore. So it is probably a first impression. The court obviously, and can see that we have cited cases from all over the mainland, other jurisdictions. They are uniform. It is simply a well-set point of law. And I don't think the new cases add anything other than just more sites. So appreciate that. Now, maybe it would help a little bit if I sort of put this case in perspective by giving a quick synopsis of what the actual material facts were. And then we can start to talk, hopefully, about, well, where did this rather simple negligence case go off the tracks and suddenly become something else? Because all we had here basically was a situation where a couple wanted to buy a house. To get the house, they had to have a mortgage. Mortgages require a bit of insurance. And because of the location of the house, where it was, no local insurance company in Hawaii was going to issue a policy. They just don't. They don't take the risk. So the mortgage company sent the plaintiffs to Mr. Winkler at Bishop Insurance Agency because they knew that Mr. Winkler, with 30, 40 years' experience getting homeowners' policies, was able to find other outside insurance companies that might give the homeowners. He was successful. He had to go through an outside broker, Seacoast, who eventually placed this policy with Lloyd's of London, an insurance company some people might consider sort of a last resort, or at least one of those that who might not find anyone else. For the next year, Mr. Winkler knew nothing had happened. He was never informed of any changes or any developments. The next thing he knew was that he got notices, copies, I should say, of notices from the carrier and its broker that the premiums were due. He did try to call, but he wasn't successful. I think he mentioned he thought he once got hold of Mrs. Reagan, but she referred it to her husband. Point was, on March 3rd, 2005, the policy lapsed. It lapsed for failure to pay the premium. 20 days later, the last day, last hour of the grace period, Mr. Regan did call Mr. Wayne and indicated he wanted to get his policy back.
Let me interrupt here, counsel, if I could. Are you saying that Mr. Wengler had received copies of notices prior to March 3rd that the policy was about to lapse?
That is the standard practice in this situation where the policy is being handled by the broker for the insurance company. In other words, it's a direct bill. The invoices are sent from Seacoast on behalf of Lloyd's directly to the insurers. The insurers simply never received it, so you know, I can't explain that. But the documentation suggests that in December, a notice was sent out to the insurers. A copy is provided to the producer, to the agent. Just a courtesy copy, and quite frankly, as a matter of just common sense, he would like to see them renew and continue it. I think he gets a few dollars commission on it. It's not much, but that's how they make their living. So they have an incentive to give a quick call and try and find out, make sure that, you know, they understand the policy, you have to pay the premium. He did. He testified that he did try to make a call. It was not successful, and the time passed, and the first he heard was on March 23rd, about 11:30. Deadline noon. At that point, there weren't a lot of options. Mr. Wengler, based on his experience, made the judgment call that it's always best to try and get the policy reinstated. That way you don't have a gap in coverage. If something were to turn up later that somebody tripped out, injured, whatever, stolen, you'd be covered. All you need to do is send your money in, sign that little declaration that says you don't know of anything, nothing's changed, nothing would interfere with reinstating the policy, and send it in. So that's what he advised they do. He also said, we'll take care of it. This end, we'll call up the broker, we'll have the underwriters contact them, which they did. And about several hours later, after the deadline passed, the local broker for Seacoast, Pat Lambert, who was actually on the Big Island, emailed back to the underwriters at Bishop, and they reported it to Mr. Wengler that actually they're very strict on this, and it's not, you know, it's really not likely, or it's not a certainty they're going to reinstate. You may have to file a second app. You have to start all over again.
Is there evidence in the record that at that point, when the renewal came up, that the insurance broker knew that the construction of the house was in progress?
No, sir.
Is there any evidence that they had knowledge of the construction being in progress?
Absolutely not. I mean, Mr. Reakin, Mrs. Reakin, everybody testified that the construction apparently started sometime around August 2004. And the house had literally been sitting up on some beams and some cribs, wooden cribs, for 8 or 9 months. But they've all testified that no one called the insurance company, no one called the broker, no one called Mr. Wingler, no one, they just didn't tell him. That's just what happened or didn't happen. So at that point, even in that conversation on March 23rd, when Mr. Reakin is talking to Mr. Wengler and asking him to, you know, help get this policy back, no mention that, oh, by the way, we did start that construction, and you know our house is at 8-9 feet here, just in case you want to know.
But is there any dispute that Mr. Reakin had informed Mr. Wengler of the plans to undertake the construction at the time that the first policy was initiated?
I think it's fair to say that there is a dispute there. Mr. Wengler has really no memory of an actual meeting. His recollection is that he's done this for the mortgage company many times. And what they do is they send in the appraisal and all the documents on the house so that he has the information he needs to get a policy. He sometimes does have to call, and he does call the insured to check on personal or little details and such. Well, at that point, obviously the appraisal or pictures, everything shows there's no construction. So on the critical issue on this case is, on the application it says, is there any construction? Little box, yes. Little box, no.
You're referring to the first policy or the
first
second?
First policy and the second, both. Same application. All right, the point was, Mr. Wingler has no real recollection of that meeting. Mr. Reakin, originally, in his answers to interrogatories and his deposition, recalled that he actually came down and met with Mr. Wengler, and that he wanted to check some things out with him. And so I went into great detail at his deposition. What did you ask? What did you say? And he basically at that point told me that, well, I told him we're going to do some renovation on the house. We're going to work on it. And I said, well, I wanted to know if, you know, I do the electrical work, because I want to do all the work myself, save money. If I do the electrical work and I start a fire, is that going to be covered? If I do the plumbing work and I get a leak and it causes damage, is that going to be covered? Those kind of things.
But based on the evidence presented at trial, could a reasonable fact finder conclude that the insurance broker agent had noticed that construction was planned?
No, Your Honor. Oh, planned. I'm sorry. Yes.
Was planned.
Yes. I think that it's a fair inference, or there's sufficient evidence in the record, that he knew they had plans to do something at some point in the future. I mean, the dispute is how much.
All right, so regardless of whether there's a dispute, one side says something, the other side says something else.
Yes.
The way we're looking at it now, as long as the fact finder could reasonably find for the other side, then we have to accept that as being the factual finding.
Understood that there was evidence to suggest that they had told of a plan to do something in the future. No timetable given.
I guess the question I have is that in the renewal part of it, when the insurance expert says, or broker agent says, I'll take care of it, does that create a duty on his part to at least make inquiries or to assure himself that the insurance that's being procured is appropriate for the situation? Or to tell the client the insurance is not going to be appropriate, it's not going to cover your situation?
I think the short answer to that is, on the facts in this case, no. And the reason is because, as you saw, the court's given us direction in Quality Furniture and Macabio, unless the agent has somehow created a special relationship or committed himself to do something more than just get a policy or get a policy back for somebody that was pre-existing, and there's no long-term relationship, there's no special payments or anything, the agent really doesn't have a duty to further advise or just out of the blue sort of inquire. In fact, that was the whole point of the company. The issue there was the plaintiffs wanted the agent to call them. It was a stacking case. And basically, they thought the agent should call them and tell them the laws on stacking had changed and really was in their benefit to stack all their car policies. And the Supreme Court, after examining it and admitting that, well, every case will run on its merits, on the facts, but where there's no special relationship, no, there's no duty for insurance agents to be calling you up or to be unilaterally asking you questions. And most of the cases across the land, if you look at them, the point is, well, that's information that the insured has. And it's really the insured's obligation to keep their agent informed or the insurance company informed of significant or material changes. There's no way an agent could know that. And to sort of put this duty back on the agent that, well, every time, or how often, every week, every month, every year, you have to call them out of the blue and say, okay, I'm going to go over all these points with you. You know, have you renovated? Have you done this? Have you upgraded? Have you added, you know, it's just not a duty that has been imposed upon insurance agents generally without a special relationship.
But in this case, counsel, didn't the broker in fact fill out a form for the new insurance and check the boxes himself that was submitted?
That is
for
correct.
The policy. But when a broker takes it on himself to fill out that form, does that change the relationship?
First, obviously, we don't have brokers here.
It's
the insurance
agent. Assuming I think there's some, at least, assertion of that.
I cannot stand here in any way, shape, or form profess that there may not have been mistakes made here. I mean, that's why I said this was a fairly straightforward negligence case. I mean, yes, when that check and that notice came back from Seacoast saying, oh, 6 weeks later, they cashed the check from Mr. Green. Everybody thought the policy had been reinstated. Then suddenly, boom, out of the blue comes this notice. And, you know, just for a moment, put yourself in the shoes of the insurance agent, 34 years experience, he knows they're bare. They have no coverage at all. If anything happens, they're in trouble. He's not thinking, gee, did they start construction? He's thinking, what if someone slips and falls? What if they have a break-in? What if there's a fire? He's thinking all the other things that can happen to a person that we get insurance for, homeowners insurance. And obviously, in hindsight, gosh, yeah, I wish you'd call them up and talk to them. But as a lot of the cases point out, we don't know what they would have said. I mean, frankly, I just can't speculate. I'd like to think that if you got down to that question on the form, are you undergoing any construction, They would have simply said, oh, yeah, yes, didn't we tell you? Oh, we're up in the air, 8, 9 feet. But frankly, they might have just thought, well, actually, we're not doing anything right now. No, we're just sitting here. I mean, I don't know what they would have said. And that's the problem with that. But absolutely, I wish he called them so that we would have that in the record and we know. Maybe it would have changed things. But unfortunately, that also brings us back to that question of, well, could we have gotten them anything? Could we have gotten them a policy? If they had told him that they were under construction, the house is 8, 9 feet up in the air, it's been that way for 8 months, he has to, the agent has to pass it on to the underwriter. The underwriters have to pass it to the insurer, and Lloyd's has told us they would never have issued the policy.
You get to that question because you say that they have to prove causation, is that right?
That's what the courts say.
But can't we, in this case, can't causation also be proven by the testimony that had I known that I was bare or that the first policy had been rescinded, that I would have stopped construction?
No. That might be, speculation. Most of the cases that we've cited and I've seen would say that's something, it's just pure speculation what the insurer would have done or might have done. Can't say that. But the facts in the case are clear that for months, Mrs. Friedkin has been on Mr. Friedkin to finish this up and get it done. Mr. Bethel, the contractor he hired, his testimony is extremely enlightening about how difficult the situation was getting. I mean, he was getting calls from Mrs. Friedkin, rather nasty calls. The point was, I'm not sure what they would have done. And I can't tell you. I can't even tell you what I think a reasonable, rational person would do because I'm not sure that's the situation we had there. So to me,
did the agent have a duty to inform the insurer that, hey, your policy lapsed? I didn't take care of it in the way that we left it. The policy lapsed. I got you a new policy.
Yeah, I think that is an excellent question that we need to present fairly and simply to the jury. Because, as you know from just looking at the dates, the policy went into effect May 9th, the house fell down May 23rd. We have 2 weeks there. Obviously, the question in my mind is that enough time for him to have said, calm down, they got their policy back, okay, we got the insurance form. And, now I need to call them and talk to them and explain what happened. Because the start and end date are going to be different. It's going to be new policy period dates. So yes, he should. The question for the jury is, how much did that work into the causation? How much did that work into, was it really such a negligent practice as to be?
So you acknowledge that part was a breach, but you're saying the question is, what did that breach cause?
Ultimately, yes. Ultimately, it all comes back to that question. If there was no insurance available, if Lloyd's was just going to deny this policy, even if we did all of these things, crossed all the T's, dotted all the I's, then we just keep coming back to square one. We can't get them what they don't, what doesn't, isn't available. I mean, frankly, we never even got to the question of what would be the premium, would they be able to pay it, because we never had any proof that any insurance company in the world would issue a policy for that risk.
Was there any difference between the original policy, had it been renewed, and the new policy as it was obtained?
Not that I'm aware of. I believe they were identical, same as the application was identical.
There was a $9 difference, right?
There was a $9 premium, yes. He actually had to do that, just to get it back quickly. I think that's kind of the point that it made this whole case sort of seem so strange, because when you look at the facts, putting aside, or we're just for the moment trying to excuse in our minds, whether things were not done in the best possible way. Everything that was done by Mr. Wengler was simply to try and help the Regents, to try and give them their policy originally, try and get it reinstated, try and get it back for them when he found out it hadn't been reinstated. I mean, it kind of raises the old adage of no good turn goes unpunished to kind of a new height. He was just an agent trying to help them. He didn't really know them, he didn't have any special relationship with them, but he did feel a duty to get the policy back for them. And that's what he did. Whether he did it correctly, properly, in the best possible manner, I'm going to have to leave that to the jury because their no question. But the jury, at least, give them their credit. Even with all of the name calling and everything else that went on in this case, and all the issues that went to them that may not have, should have been, they still found Mr. Wingler only 20% liable, and the plaintiff 40%, twice as liable. So at least the jury seemed to think that when you hold those two parties up next to each other, it wasn't Mr. Wingler who was committing the bulk of the problems here, or the negligence, or the mistakes, or the misjudgments, or however you wish to characterize it. What I'd like to do, what I'd hope to, is we just have a
fair... How does that help you? Because if we sustain a jury's verdict, it's adverse to your client.
Absolutely, Your Honor, I understand that. The problem here is there were so many other things that happened. I mean, first, obviously, there's this legal question. I call it one of first impression because I can't find any Hawaii case that says, right on point, one way or another, do you have to show proof that you could get a policy, some to cover this risk? It's kind of a unique risk.
So is your key argument the lack of duty?
Key argument is causation, is that if we can't get you the policy, I'm sorry, that just kind of moots everything else because there are no other claims. All the claims revolve around the failure to procure a policy that would cover this risk.
Does the first place insurance policy address that?
That's a good point, you know, because I think, I won't smile here, but I think Countrywide kind of hung themselves there. Countrywide put forced policy into effect, and by doing so themselves, they removed any basis for objection to the condition of the house or any misrepresentations or any mistakes. They just wiped out all their defenses to the policy. That's why I think in the end, after I mean, a year and a half of squabbling, they finally cut a deal with the plaintiffs, which I'm not entirely, you know, privy to, but, you know, that's, at least they got something out of it, and I'm glad that happened. But it was very unique, it was different. It might be a lesson for all mortgage companies about don't jump too quick to put forced coverage in because you are basically taking away any possible objection you might have to the situation that is going on because you didn't ask. You didn't go out and check. I mean, if Countrywide had gone out and looked, oh my gosh, who knows what would happen? They did, about what would happen. So that's a very interesting question. I mean, it really, kind of only plays here because I think we argued at least they got some money, they could have mitigated damages. You know, it was a pretty minor side issue in the grand scope of things.
So the existence of that policy isn't evidence that a policy is possible?
No. The question here is, would any other insurance company issue a policy for that risk of the house with 9 feet here? I'm seeing about out of time, so I'm just going to probably have to rely pretty much on a brief here. But the other critical issues, obviously, were that I can't explain why the court let the plaintiffs use all of these other acts and just basically call Mr. Wingler terrible things. I mean, these were defaults in a bankruptcy that they were contested, they were American, they were nothing. And let him use those over and over again. And then the whole issue of, well, shouldn't even talk about this forgery of the signature, when, frankly, that was not the basis for the decision. It had no material basis in the case, but of course it was highly prejudicial, really terrible. And then to let punitives go, when, as I said, really, you look hard, you're only going to find negatives at most here or mistakes of judgment.
So your position is that the agent had no duty to advise the insured that the policy that the insured was obtaining would not cover the principal risk that the insured was worried about in this case?
Not only that, but also that he couldn't have advised him because he was not informed. That's where I was saying all the cases that we've looked at, kind of come close to this, they say, well, that's information that's unique to the insurer. You can't expect an insurance agent to be some kind of seer or prophet.
Right, but would the special responsibility be triggered if he had received information, notice of the fact that the purpose of the policy was to cover this construction project?
Oh, I don't think there's any doubt. If the Briefings had called up Mr. Wingler in August or whenever they started this construction and said, oh, good news, we started our construction, the house is now 8-9 feet up in the air, I mean, that would have set off listings. He would have had to report that to the underwriter broker and the carrier, I think we know now what would have happened, because Lloyd's made that absolutely clear. They never issued the policy, they came in and they rescinded the policy. And that's the law of the case. I mean, that's done. 54B, appeal periods passed, that's just the way it was. And I don't really see any wrong with that. The other issues that came up as far as, well, we've covered them, I hope, in our briefs. They are ones that have been addressed by this court and the Supreme Court various times. And what is the meaning of agency? And there was terrible confusion there because all through the trial we're talking about Mr. Wenger's an agent, there's an agency, and then suddenly we're talking about principal agent. Even the jury instructions are given in such a manner that they kind of hopscotch back and forth. It doesn't surprise me the jury got confused. And in fact, I think that shows most when you look at the jury verdict and you see that they did not find outrageous behavior to justify intentional infliction, but then they turned around under a clear and convincing and found damages. Down you go for you. The case, unfortunately, just said went off the tracks. All we really would like is to get it straightened out. I think it's over now, but if we have to go back, give us a fair trial. I've got to stop.
May it please the court. It's been 7 years, 7 months, and 17 days since the Reakins house collapsed and they were left without insurance coverage because of the wrongdoing of Mr. Wengler and Bishop Insurance. We're not talking about mere technical violations. What we're talking about are grave and serious breaches of the fundamental duties that insurance agents owe to their clients. Tell the truth. Keep your clients informed about the status of their policy. If a policy can't be reinstated, tell them that. Tell the client if the premium's refunded. Don't use their monies without getting authorization from them. And obviously, don't fill out an application if you haven't talked to the client. Forgery is never acceptable. Even if you're trying in some fashion, thinking that you're helping somebody, by doing that, you're not helping them. You're costing them their insurance. That's a totally inappropriate approach to that situation. Why are these basic principles so important? It's because we're dealing with people's homes, and so when these basic duties are violated, the damages and the consequences, the repercussions, they're life-altering. They're very severe. The appellants began their case by blaming the Reakins. Right? They said that this was a direct bill policy. They were receiving these notices. They should have paid their premium earlier. We proved at trial that wasn't the case. It wasn't a direct bill policy. Mr. Wengler messed up. The bills were being sent to Argent Mortgage, the original lender on the property. Afterwards, the mortgage was sold a couple of times. Steve made efforts to contact Mr. Wengler and said, you need to notify the new lenders that we have insurance. He didn't follow up timely with that.
If the original policy had been renewed without incident, would there be any claim against the defendants?
I don't believe so, because I believe the policy would have provided coverage for the incident that occurred. Tom Black, he was the adjuster who was hired by Lloyd's to come in and evaluate this. When he was looking at that policy, the policies are identical, as you mentioned. He said, you got a great policy. It covers collapse. There's a specific section in the policy that says collapse caused by defective methods or means of construction is a covered risk. So they would have had coverage if this had been properly renewed.
So even though the app for the first policy said no construction underway, it still would have covered it, you said?
That's correct. That's correct. That was an accurate representation at the time it was made. The only reason that coverage was denied was because of this second, the secret application that the Reakins had no knowledge of, where Mr. Wengler inserted inaccurately the response to the question about whether construction was ongoing, and he checked no incorrectly. So that was their error. Going back to the sequence of the...
So say that again. You're saying the only reason why the first policy would have covered it, but the second policy didn't, is because with respect to the second policy, there was a misrepresentation that there was ongoing construction.
Correct.
If there was no statement about whether or not construction was happening, it would have been a covered risk under the first policy?
Correct. And Tom Black, the adjuster for Lloyd's.
And presumably under the second policy too, but for the misrepresentation.
Correct. Substantively, the policies were the same in terms of the risk that was being covered. So, in terms of the knowledge of these premiums, getting back to that, the we do know that Wengler and Bishop Insurance received notice that the policy renewal was up. Carol Young was the personal lines manager at Bishop Insurance. She testified to that, and she testified that she told Wengler, hey, go follow up with the Reakins. What's the status of this renewal? That's what she instructed him to do. She was concerned, she testified, because she didn't want to see them left without coverage. But he didn't do that. He dropped the ball. Steve and Pam testified that he never followed up. The jury believed that. There were some comments now that, Mr. Wengler thought he may have called Mrs. Reakin. The jury didn't, there was conflicting evidence on that. The jury discounted it. They believed Mr. Reakin and Mrs. Reakin that the first notice they received that there was an issue with this was on March 23rd, 2005, when Steve was opening the mail and he received that lapse notice.
Let me ask you one more question about this.
Sure.
When you renew a policy, are you obligated to tell the insurance company of material changes in the original condition under which the first policy was obtained? In other words, would he have a duty to tell the insurance company that, you know, when the original policy was issued, I wasn't constructing anything, but now my house is 8 feet off the ground?
Okay. Well, I think that would be based on the specific terms of the policy. This policy doesn't appear to have any statement like that. And certainly what was being sent to Mr. Reakin was your payments due, send in the check. There was no...
So this is like an automatic renewal policy. You send in the check, you're covered.
Yeah.
Under the terms of the original policy.
Correct. And at least from Mr. Reakin's perspective, I would also note that he testified quite credibly that he recalled a specific meeting with Mr. Wengler on March 2nd, 2005 at Bishop Insurance's office. He was excited about purchasing his house, going forward with the plans. He brought the plans with him. He thought he was getting insurance that, you know, he was going to be getting insurance from Bishop Insurance themselves. And he was there. He thought he was talking to the insurance company saying, you know, here's my plans. Here's what I want to do. I want to make sure I'm covered. Can you help me out with that? So that's how.
Was there any evidence that the agent was notified of the ongoing nature of the construction? The appellant counsel argued that there was no evidence that they were told that the house was undergoing construction when the new policy was issued. Is that your understanding of the record?
Yeah. At the time when Steve received that lapse notice, Mr. Reakin received the lapse notice, and he called Mr. Wengler, I don't believe that they had a specific conversation about construction ongoing at that time. But from Steve's perspective, what he did testify to was that he believed, Mr. Wengler, he believed the insurance company was aware of these plans for the construction because they went into such great detail about this at their original meeting on that point. So, when Steve got the lapse notice, what did he do? He called Mr. Wengler. He called Mr. Wengler because the form that he received, it had Mr. Wengler's name on it, it had Bishop Insurance's name on it, and it had Mr. Wengler's number. So he reached out. This wasn't a situation where there was, we're not saying that he had some unsolicited duty to contact Mr. Reakin. Mr. Reakin reached out to Mr. Wengler for help, said, I just got this notice, what do I do? Help me out. And Mr. Wengler gave him very specific instructions about what to do. Steve followed those instructions to a T, did exactly what he was told to do. And Mr. Wengler said, I'll take care of it. And what's important about that is that immediately after that...
What was his understanding of, or what's the evidence of his understanding of, I'll take care of it? What did that signify to your client?
Policy would be in place. We've got coverage. No worries. It was reinforced by the fact that his premium payment check had been cashed. In evidence, we had their bank statement that showed the check cashed on March 30th. So from Mr. Reakin's perspective, everything seemed to be okay. There was no indication of any problem whatsoever. And that's the real crux. Another part of the problem here that we have is that Bishop Insurance and Wengler knew on March 23rd, 2005, that that policy could not be reinstated. We have the memo that Carol Young typed up that was in evidence. She said, I just talked to Seacoast. They're not going to do it. You need to rewrite a policy. You need to do a new policy. Carol Young also, she was the personal lines manager again at Bishop Insurance. She testified to that. They have a detailed computer log that details all the activity. it was also reflected in that, that they knew on that date they weren't going to be able to reinstate. So what did they do with that important information, right? Mr. Wengler, counsel was saying that Mr. Wengler realized that they were without coverage in May, and so he filled out another application. Well, what did he do on March 23rd, 2005, when he realized they were without coverage? He did nothing. They sat on it. Didn't tell Steve, didn't tell the Ricans that their policy had been lapsed or terminated, that they were without coverage. They didn't do anything. And then he waits, right? It's till May 9th of 2005. Suddenly he realizes, oh, we got a problem here, right? The opposing side says, they were just trying to help the Ricans out. This is the worst possible thing they could have done to help out the Ricans, to forge a policy, make inaccurate representations, and cost them the coverage that they were relying on. Steve testified very credibly that if he knew that they were without insurance, he would have stopped construction, he would have looked for alternative sources of coverage if that was necessary, but the point was he was denied of that opportunity to take those alternative steps simply because the insurance agent didn't do what they were supposed to do. Just tell them. All he had to do was say, you know what, it didn't work out, we need to rewrite. But they didn't take that simple step. And in terms of the policy, the application that he filled out, it was a forgery. The evidence was overwhelming on that point. Steve and Pam, Mr. and Mrs. Ricken both testified. Mr. Ricken's signature. We had an expert come in and testify. That's an inauthentic signature. There was no evidence presented that it could have been Mr. Ricken's signature. The only people who had access to that document were Carol Young, the personal lines manager at Bishop Insurance, and Mr. Wengler, the only two. When Carol Young typed up the application, she testified she gave it back to Mr. Wengler and said, you need a signature on that from Mr. Ricken. And Mr. Wengler testified he got the signature. He brought it back. But that was in May 9th, and the signed application is May 10th. So there was no testimony about how that could have gotten to Mr. Ricken to have him sign that.
Maybe I'm misremembering something, counsel. I thought I remembered Mr. Wengler saying he didn't recall getting Mr. Ricken's signature.
Yeah. There were two parts in the testimony where when I followed up, he clarified that he couldn't recall either way whether or not how he didn't know how the signature got on the document was the.
Does he deny that it's his signature, or says he doesn't know?
His testimony, to the best of my recollection, was looks close enough to me. Looks the same.
This is Mr. Wengler's testimony.
Correct. Yeah. So.
So what's your response to the causation argument, which is all this didn't matter because no insurance company would have insured the situation, given the situation? I understand your first argument is that the first policy would have covered it. But
thank you. I'm happy to answer that question. One of the cases that Bishop Insurance cited was this Prince case that was from the Seventh Circuit. We don't agree with many of the other holdings in that case, but one of the things they said was inherent in the obligation to seek continuation of an insurance policy is the duty to notify the applicant if the insurer declines to continue the risk so that the applicant may not be lulled into a feeling of security or put into prejudicial delay in seeking protection elsewhere. And in that case, the other side made the same type of argument here, but you can't prove that somebody would have insured this. And the court there said, that's not the question. The question is, did you fulfill your duty to notify them that they couldn't obtain insurance, and give them the opportunity to seek coverage elsewhere? So we think that's an important point, that they can't deny the Ricans the opportunity to look elsewhere and then say, well, haha, you can't prove that there's an insurance policy that would provide coverage. I think that's an important argument, and the case that they cite, again, Prince versus Royal Indemnity, says that.
Well, what in this case triggered the agent's duty to tell the insured that the insurance policy was inappropriate? The appellant's argument is, how do I know if it's inappropriate if you don't tell me? You didn't tell me, so I don't have any duty to inform you of the appropriateness of the policy.
And so on that point, I think we had good evidence before the jury that Mr. Griffin specifically asked Mr. Wengler, I want coverage to cover this construction that I plan to do. Here are the plans. Get me a policy that will cover this. So he affirmatively gave Mr. Wengler information, asked him to evaluate the appropriateness of the coverage. And the testimony that we put on from the expert, Ken Kanahiro, was that at the very least, if you got that information, you had a duty to go and talk to the underwriter, to look at other alternatives, and perhaps even to get more information about the plans, but none of that happened. And so what he did say was, yeah, you'll be covered for this. And so when he chose to respond to those inquiries, that triggered the duty. But in addition to the duty about advising properly on the type of coverage and what type of policy they should have, the other important duty was simply when the policy couldn't be reinstated, he had a duty to tell them that, not to go and do a secret application and forge his signature and take their refund check and apply it without their knowledge. Right? That was the absolute wrong thing for him to do. All he needed to do was call and say, we couldn't get coverage. What do you want to do? He didn't do that. And so I think that in terms of the causation issue, that's another point in time where we have something that was done inappropriately that resulted in damages.
But if your client was told, okay, this is what happened, well, we got this exact same policy we had before, is there any evidence he would have done something different? In other words, you're saying he should have been told what he did.
Yeah.
What the agent's argument is, what I did was I procured him the exact same policy he had.
Which was worth nothing because he didn't consult with the Reifens first. He didn't ask them, go through the application with them to see if, the construction was ongoing at that point. So what he did was it cost them their coverage. So there was no value to that policy he obtained for them because of that. And the Reifens were denied, the opportunity to make decisions about that simply because he chose that course of action for them. And when he chose that course of action for him, he assumed a special duty to make sure that he fulfilled that properly. He did. He got a policy that wasn't worth anything. And because of what he did, and this is an important part that sometimes I forget to mention or it gets lost, is because of what they did, the Reifens were then accused of insurance fraud. Right? They got sued by Lloyd's of London saying, you nice homeowners up in Hulu, you were trying to defraud, Lloyd's of London because you filled out this application inappropriately. And so that adds to this whole problem that occurs afterwards when the Reifens are trying to figure out what the heck's going on, right? And they're being accused by the insurance company of defrauding them. There's a second application. They know nothing about it. Right? That's adding to their stress. They're trying to figure out what's going on. They don't know. They don't understand. All that Bishop Insurance and Wengler, what they should have done at that point, right? They had multiple opportunities to step up and say, you know what? We're sorry. Here's what we did. We filled out this application. We shouldn't have done it, but here's what we did. We had to go all the way through a trial just to prove that the Reifens didn't know anything about this application. They had to be put through that whole process just because they wouldn't admit what they did. If they were really trying to help out the Reifens, the first thing they would have done is said, you know what? We were just trying to help you out. We're sorry. We did it the wrong way. It violates Hawaii law. But, here's what happened. They didn't do that. And I think that is one of the factors that the jury looked at in terms of considering the amount of damages and the type of damages that were awarded, is that Bishop Insurance and Mr. Wengler had multiple opportunities to make this right, and they chose not to do it. Their whole defense through trial was, we're not responsible, nothing happened, the Reifens are faking, they're making this up. That was their choice that they made. And the jury considered all the evidence that we put on and said, you know what? They set this up as a credibility test between Mr. Wengler and Mr. Reifen, and the jury believed Mr. Reifen. And we think that obviously weighs heavily on whether this decision should be affirmed or not, because a lot of this deals with evaluating factual findings that were made by the jury in terms of which witnesses they believed or didn't believe and the total sum, the quantity of the evidence that was presented.
If I could get back to causation, wasn't it your own motion in limine which precluded essentially the introduction of evidence on the part of the Bishop defendants that might have allowed them to argue that this wouldn't have been covered under the policy.
As I understood, what they were trying to say was that, well, two responses to that question. The first is the collapse of the house has nothing, the actual cause of the collapse of the house has nothing to do with the issues in the trial. It was investigated by the fire department, by the police, by the building inspector, by HIOSH, by Lloyd's of London's own adjuster, Tom Black. They all concluded that the cause of the collapse was defective materials. The glue lam beams were not properly braced. That was it. The other side didn't have any construction expert, structural engineer, anybody who was competent who could come in and testify as to any other alternative cause for the collapse. There was testimony from a laborer who said he heard that Steve may have been doing something with a hammer right before the collapse, but that was the extent of it.
So what evidence was allegedly erroneously excluded regarding the collapse?
I think it's that this laborer heard that Steve may have.
And you put on your case included evidence of the investigations that the investigation's conclusion as to what caused the collapse, you said the defective materials, or was that totally kept out?
The judge kept a very tight rein on that. And my recollection is that we got up to the point that the glue lams were not properly braced, and that was the extent of it. I think Tom Black testified to that. He may have also testified that the spacing of the glue lams, these are the beams that were supporting the house while it was being lifted, that the spacing between them was too wide and should have been narrower.
Did someone, I should check this myself, I guess, but did someone from Lloyd's or BIA or Mr. Wengler testify specifically as to what would have happened if the box had been checked? Yes, there's ongoing construction. Did someone say at that point there would be another inquiry, or at that point we would not have issued the policy? What was that testimony?
Absolutely. So the testimony, well, we didn't have anybody from Lloyd's of London testify, but we had Carol Young, who was the personal lines manager from Bishop Insurance, and her testimony was once that box is checked, then it goes to a different underwriter review, so there would have been a different analysis that would have been undertaken. And Ken Kanahiro, our insurance expert, also testified to that once the, if the box is checked, construction ongoing, then you need to look at all different alternatives.
But not that it's uninsurable.
Correct. And so what Ken Kanahiro testified, our insurance expert, was at that point you go to the underwriter and say, can we get an endorsement to cover this specific type of risk? And Tom Black, the insurance adjuster from that was hired by Lloyd's, said this was a common construction technique in Hawaii. And so I think there was sufficient evidence in the record to...
And the check box was the basis for Lloyd saying there's misrepresentation in procuring the policy. What is the statement that's checked precisely, if you recall?
I believe it's actually just under construction, and it's either a Y/N where there's a check box.
And your client's position is that I never saw that form, I never checked that box.
Absolutely. There's no evidence in the record to support that. Even Mr. Wengler testified that he never went over the form with Mr. Vreeken, never discussed it with him, never went over the questions separately, never gave him a copy of the application. So Mr. Vreeken's first knowledge of that application was when we discovered it in discovery. I did want to address briefly the issue of the damages that were awarded. There was a suggestion that the damages should be capped at the amount of the policy. That's based on a case from Minnesota. We don't think it comports with Hawaii law. We think that in this situation where the insured suffered significant damages because the policy was not obtained, because this is a tort action. It's would make bad law to impose a cap on special damages, essentially on contract theories, based on this law from, or this case from Minnesota. I think Hawaii law is clear that special damages are all damages that naturally flow from the consequences of the wrongdoing. And so in this case, one reason that the special damages were, we had special damages, and we proved special damages in excess of $372,000. A big chunk of that was rent that was paid by the Vreekins because of what happened. The delays in resolving this, they had to bounce around from house to house, different rentals, and so that's continuing to this day. So we think it would be inappropriate to leave the insureds to suffer that risk in a tort action like this, that they wouldn't be fully compensated for all of their losses. I think ultimately the appellants didn't lose this trial because of evidentiary or legal errors. They lost because the Vreekins presented substantial and overwhelming evidence. The appellants, again, made a strategic decision to make this a test of the credibility between Mr. Vreekin and Mr. Wengler, and they lost on that. We think the jury got it right, and we would urge the court to affirm the verdict in all respects. Thank you.
Thank you.
I just have a few minutes, so I'm just trying to address a couple of things. Simplest is the Prince case that didn't involve an insurance agent at all. It had to do with the vendor who sold this property and who would get the benefit of the insurance policy. Totally irrelevant. We cited it for simply legal principles. As far as the question just addressed about, was there any evidence that no policy would have issued? Well, of course there was. I mean, Mr. Wood's declaration in the deck action part of this case, submitted on behalf of Lloyds of London, clearly said that if they had learned that this house was up in the air, no policy would issue, period. I mean, you can't get more blunt than that. And Judge King was checking that and read the motion.
Mr. Hershey, my question was more to the interim step, not the ultimate. Did they know, if they knew it was 9 feet up in the air, if the form was filled out with the Y circled instead of the N circled, then what would have happened? Because I think the house being 9 feet up in the air is a couple steps down the road.
I think that's an excellent question, which I don't think we got into, because as Justice Rutherford pointed out, we weren't allowed to really get to that level of what caused the accident and whether it might be excluded under even the policy language. So we didn't bring in an expert on coverage issues to try and determine whether, well, under these circumstances, what if an owner starts to build something like that, doesn't follow the recommendations of the contractor, hires unlicensed and uninsured people to do the work, and then literally does knock the house down with a pipe wrench, it turned out. Would that policy have been voided simply because of his actions or his own misjudgments and miscalls and mistakes? And we didn't get to that level because, frankly, the judge cut us off. He said, we're not going to go there.
But he didn't cut you off until the day of trial, right? Or the day before trial, the motion for limine.
That's true.
So what were you proposing to introduce?
Well, we're proposing to bring it up and rebuttal testimony if necessary, if they claim that it would have been covered.
Was there a specific proffer on that? What evidence was excluded on that issue?
I'd have to go back and look at the motion in limine and the briefs on that, and particularly the transcript. I have a recollection that we talked about, that's what we anticipated.
Was there expert testimony excluded, or was it just?
I think our point was, and it was partially granted, was that because the plaintiffs had not come forward with any expert testimony on coverage issues, Mr. Kimishita is a fine gentleman, teaches CLE programs, but he was not an insurance person in the sense of a coverage expert, and he was not allowed to testify and did not testify there would be coverage.
But if the right box was checked, even according to your analysis, the homeowner, the insured would have been informed that you're not covered.
I think that's what would have happened, yes.
Right. So would that have affected his behavior? Isn't that a causation question?
It does. I think that's a good question down the road. I mean, I admit a lot of cases say that you're just getting too far away. That's sheer speculation, in the Hood case in particular. But yes, there are a number of mysteries. I mean, the biggest mystery is this forgery, this signature. You know, I pointed out that it really didn't prove anything in the case. It wasn't the basis for rescission, but it had such horrible negative connotations, even worse than the bankruptcy mentioned. But it's a mystery. I don't know. Mr. Wingler testified.
What's your position on the appellee's argument that the original policy, had it been properly renewed, would have covered this incident?
My opinion is it would not.
Because?
Because they failed to inform the insurance company of a material and significant change in the structure and the development of the property.
Is that in the original? Sorry.
I was going to ask that. What provision of the original policy?
I'm sorry, I didn't. Yeah.
But you said it is in the original policy.
I believe that is inherent in it, and I believe that this policy from Lloyd's would say that. I'd have to go back and review it and look and find the exact language. But it is such an integral part of all insurance policies that the insurer has to keep the insurance company apprised of significant material changes. For it not to be there, it would be shocking. And that's about all I have time to say, except for the last thing, which is I still can't figure out why Bishop Insurance Agency was left in this case. They were simply a conduit, as I think many of you know quite well. An independent insurance agent has to hang his license somewhere. It allows him access to various carriers, but he is an independent agent by law. The agency cannot manage or supervise him. That would turn it into an employee relationship, which they don't want, because then the clients become the agency clients. And so they're trying to remain independent. But they were the ones who basically are the biggest kind of wild card in this whole thing. Why they were left in, how the jury could have found, I can only presume that it was because they thought they had a duty to manage, and they did.
All right. Thank you, counsel. I think you're a pleasure. We'll take this case under advisement.
All right.